You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to National Security Law Today. Last week, we explored the foundations of AI with Dr. Vijay Jinapareddy, breaking down the different types of AI systems, how they're trained, and the ethical dilemmas of sourcing data. This week, we're picking up where we left off, diving into AI's growing appetite for data, its increasing energy demands, and what these challenges mean for security and sustainability. As always, thanks for tuning in, and here's Elisa.
AI and AI systems require different computing functions. And I'd like for you to talk about two things, which is one, what do they require in terms of technology like chips? And what do they require in terms of energy compared to other computing functions and why?
It'll blow people's mind to understand that what AI does is actually remarkably simple. And that's why we've gotten so hungry for it. If something's actually complicated, it actually makes it really hard to scale it because there's just so much complexity in there. And it's hard to kind of, you know, meander through all the different pathways. Now, AI is so simple at the elemental level because all you have to do is multiply two numbers and add it to a number. This is called a MAC unit, multiply, accumulate. This one thing that we do is just something we do at a trillion parameter scale. We just replicate it because it's so simple. Then you can just take these two numbers, which you can then pack into a nice little matrix, which ties into linear algebra. At that point, everything is just a matrix and matrix vector computation. Very basic computation. And that is almost infinitely parallel. My colleagues might get a little riled up when I say that infinitely parallel. There are system level bottlenecks that we hit and so forth that we have to work around. But the fundamental primitive pattern that's in there is so parallel that you can easily throw more and more of that very simple multiply. And so because of that, what ends up happening is that you can scale this thing in infinitely large. And that's what happened with GPT-3. That was the big kind of thing that if you actually look at it on the technical plots, you'll see that there's a parameter band gap where suddenly they kind of push into this, you know, very large model size. And then bingo, you start seeing this sort of few-shot training capabilities that start emerging in it. That's what we sort of observed. And that's where that thirst is coming for bigger models. It's not necessarily that bigger is better. But the thing that's always happened in computing systems has been that, like, if I can scale the compute, then it's naturally going to lead to newer capabilities. And that's that race that we're in right now. What else are we going to discover that these things are going to be able to do? We know they can code. We know they're able to have full-on conversation. We know that they're able to take text and video and combine them together. They're able to generate images. Next, Netflix is going to be the new blockbuster. Why do I say that? Because essentially you can think of it as like, you can put in a prompt and you're going to get your custom movie in 2 weeks. 2 weeks is very quickly going to become 5 seconds and, you know, a couple of years later. And so the point is that because it's such a very simple multiply and accumulate function that you're doing, and you can scale it to trillions of parameters, then you start building bigger and bigger systems that are highly specialized for it. There's lots of system complexity about how do I manage it once it goes off from one computer to, you know, I have to put two computers together to I have to put a data center together. Now it's like, okay, a data center from one data center to another data center. That's where I think it gets interesting, where it's very simple to do. But that simplicity is essentially why we're able to scale and say like, oh, I just need more power. If I can pack power in, then I can turn the computer on. If I can turn the computer on, then that means I can actually get a bigger model to run. The elemental aspect is so basic that that's why we're able to scale and demand more and more power.
Yeah, and then the data centers require obviously cooling. They have to be maintained stable, which takes energy for any number of reasons. And every time we gear up to do a search, my understanding is it even requires water consumption. It's requiring an enormous amount of energy. Now, with respect to the chips, it's just not any computer chip, right? I mean, that's why, for example, NVIDIA has become the darling of the stock market. But what is different about those chips, for example, than any ordinary chip?
They're essentially domain-specific chips, as we call them. NVIDIA's history has always been coming from gaming. In gaming, there's a lot of parallelism available because you're often dealing with, you know, triangles or shaders that you're trying to, you know, just everything is literally a triangle that you're actually computing. And so there's a lot of different triangles. And so there's always inherently, when you look at a picture, there's a lot of parallelism inside that you can actually exploit. And that's always been the bread and butter of NVIDIA. And over time, they were clever about sort of putting in capabilities where they took advantage of that parallelism to help with scientific workloads and so forth in the early 2006, 2007. In 2012, Alex came out with this paper because he took a GPU class, which was NVIDIA's, you know, architecture class. You know, I always tell my students, don't be surprised what you can do in a class project because it might change the world.
Yes, definitely.
And Alex was, you know, doing this project where he, you know, took the class and he tried to cram a neural network in, which has a lot of parallelism, as I said, like, because it's just multiply accumulate, there's a lot of algorithmic level inherent parallelism. It's just matrix, matrix, matrix vectors. And if you're able to combine that onto the GPU, which is inherently, you know, massively parallel, by design, it's inherently massively parallel. It's got over 26,000 cores or so, as compared to a CPU, which is like, you know, a 2-core or a 4-core when you buy something. But the cores are very different. A CPU core is a very complex core. An NVIDIA core is a very simple core, but that's okay because when we talk about a Mac unit, multiply, accumulate, that's a very simple thing that you have to do. Now, if you can stamp out, you know, a few million of these things, then that's great. That's what has helped NVIDIA sort of become pioneers. It just kind of naturally fell into it. And of course, they did a lot of work in making the software easy and so forth. And now they've got this massive moat because there's entire libraries that are built up, there's entire blogs and, you know, developer experience that's out there in the world. So it only just kind of fuels, you know, the development on the platform. And right now, everybody wants to be that astronaut who's doing something cool with a neural network model.
It sounds like this requires, though, let's go back for just a second, a lot of data access ongoing, right? The ability to add to the existing data. And I guess the question is, do we continue to build data centers? I mean, do you see anything in the future where we're able to do this with less consumption of energy? Because obviously this is increasingly significant to potentially the planet, right? And the other thing is, where are we going to get those sources of energy? What you're saying, I guess, is the amount of computing goes up so high when you're into these trillions of replications. So as we build on these models, do you see that amount of energy ever going down, or do you see it just needing to be continually increased as we get into these greater technologies? Have you given a lot of thought to that?
Yeah, my area of expertise is actually edge computing, which is, you know, everything that is typically on your laptop on downwards. And right now, one of the big areas of interest really is around edge AI. You're going to have these large models that are big and so forth. But there's an interesting thing that you just touched on, which is like, okay, well, how are we going to feed the data and so forth? The reality is this, at least now, this is kind of coming more from my sort of research bias, which is these big models are amazing once you have all the data that's up there. But the reality is we're running out of data. There have been studies that have shown that we're literally running out of data. We're not, you know, I'm not talking about running out of data in 50 years. I'm talking about literally running out of data within the next 5 to 7 years, like completely exhausted data. However, there is a wealth of data. And you might be like, what? You just said there's no data. Like, you know, you're taking all the data. The place where models haven't quite met the world is where digital and the analog world kind of come together. These ChatGPT models and all this kind of, they live in this digital realm. They don't actuate or deal with physical data. Physical data is literally me breathing and, you know, all the sensor data that's streaming through. If you kind of collect that data, the entire infrastructure will collapse. So today's cloud-based or data center-based models are simply not approached by which you can actually do the next generation of AI, which is, you know, you want AI everywhere. And so increasingly what we're seeing is that AI technology is moving more closer to where the sensors are. We've seen this for a long time. Why does your smartphone have AI running on it? Well, it's because you want the picture to look good. Well, yeah, you can make the picture look good by just taking that picture and very quickly sending it to the cloud and bringing it back. That doesn't always work because the latency is high. You know, there's actual data costs associated with it. So that's why you move the compute to where the data actually sits. Historically, we've been moving the data to where the compute sits in the data center. But to make this sort of feasible, we're now kind of going the other way, which is, okay, let's just move the compute over to where the data is, because data movement is usually 1,000 times or more costly than the simple multiply accumulate. Moving a bit of data is that much more costly as compared to just doing that multiply and accumulate. And with that, essentially, we're kind of coming more towards this space where, like, you know, let's deal with that raw sensor sort of a data. And then I think like that sort of opens up to a whole new rich array of different kinds of models, models that are not necessarily big, because essentially what you're looking for is that needle in a haystack. And you don't have to look at all the data for that. You just need to identify the critical bits of data. Already right now, the new buzzword in research is really SLMs, not LLMs, small language models. When you're talking about the big models, you're really pushing for every small inch of performance improvement, Versus when you're talking about things deploying at scale, you're talking about efficiency as well.
Let me ask you this, though. You know, I've been listening to some of the hearings that have occurred on the Hill, and one of the conversations that's being had around AI is not that we're running out of data as much as we're running out of usable data. I'm wondering if the science anticipates any mechanism by which unusable data could be converted to usable data, and if so, what that would take.
We often think about it as synthetic data generators or data augmentation methods. So essentially, you just take a little bit of good data, and out of that little bit of good data, you generate a corpus of other combinations of data. So the simplest example for people to understand this would be their pattern detectors, essentially. So if, for example, I'm looking at a picture of a cat, well, normally, when you and I hold a picture of a cat, we're just going to hold a picture of a cat where the face is up, right? The ears are pointing upwards, you know, the mouth is downwards, just like a regular face. But you can take that one picture and I can twist and crop and, like, you know, try to make it look from the side and skew it and all. I can do 1,000 different variations out of one picture. And that's all good data because I know it's a cat. So there's lots of data augmentation or data-centric operations that you would actually perform on this in order to take a little bit of good data, create a large corpus of data. And of course, your methods and assessing is that new large corpus or high fidelity and so forth. But that's essentially how a lot of companies are heading. So if you look at NVIDIA, for instance, they've got massive synthetic data generators. The Omniverse, for instance, is an example because they essentially want to create an entire digital twin of literally everything so you can actually evaluate every possible scenario in there in a virtual world. You don't have to necessarily rely on physical data.
Let's just take a minute and talk a little bit about national security in the sense that everybody wants to live in a safe country. What do you think are some of the AI applications for national security? I'm not talking just about weapon systems here, but in general, do you see an application for this technology that might be in the interest of sort of like maintaining peace, maintaining order? Have you given any thought to where some of those models could lead? And I'm not just talking about U.S. national security, but any country.
Short answer is no. I'm not giving much thought to that.
Okay, but do now, okay? Like maybe that twilight moment before you go to sleep where you're like, no, that I didn't want to think about that.
Much of my thought has generally been in like outreach of education and so forth around this is how do you bring equilibrium into that space? But if I had to think on the fly, I'm trying to think of examples.
You know, you're a dad and a scientist. I mean, you want a stable environment for your family to thrive, right? I wonder, because we always think about national security and AI in the context of weapon systems, if there isn't a human application here from some of these predictive models that might allow countries to communicate better in the interest of preventing conflict.
It's certainly possible, but where my head's going is like, wow, but isn't that effectively having to look at everyone's data?
But there are private companies that have nothing to do with, for example, intelligence collection that are in a position to be accumulating data that might be useful in this regard. And who owns that? And who has the ability to take that data and form a diplomatic response or a military response? I think with some of these predictive models, we go there. And then there's a possible positive application here. It could also be exploited to subjugate, I think, countries' vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about private industry. We don't even have to get into, say, for example, what's available to the Defense Department components.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I often have a real struggle when it comes to like anything with space and being able to kind of look at things from that scale. And the reason is because at that point, it's a shared space. But when it comes to like that sort of, you know, observing things from space, then we're essentially crossing into like, well, it's like we should really be thinking all of this space is just one big blue ball because, you know, I have as much right to the air that I breathe, you know, as you should, right? And at that point, I think it becomes very tricky in understanding, well, when is this something good? Because in everything else, we often say, well, if you're looking at something, well, you shouldn't be looking at that. That's what I'm doing. I have a very hard time kind of understanding how people generally think about this because I tend to be too positive on, we're all just one species.
Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. But I do think that there may be a time when predictive models could potentially be used to diffuse conflict. Mm-hmm. That might be a really important use of them going forward, and particularly if they get to the point where they predict human behavior or trends.
I would think that we're already doing that is what I would think, though. The predictive modeling, I think, like, I'm assuming that someone must already be doing because those are kind of well-established methods. Are we going to have autonomous agents that are doing this? And I think then it becomes a very interesting question.
ethical autonomous agents of no
Yeah,
particular
exactly.
nationality. Yeah, no, it's not going to be the March of the Drones or something out of Star Wars. Okay, in your world, in your sphere, you must have concerns about the ideas that you hear bandied around in Washington. We need to regulate the data. We need to regulate AI. We want to be careful here because we don't want to thwart scientific growth. But just tell me from your perspective, when scientists hear this, what is their reaction, say, to the junior senator from one of the A states saying, we want to regulate this stuff? And what would you prefer to see coming out of like Congress and Washington on these topics of regulating, constraining AI growth and development and scientific research?
I think scientists, people like me, we do get very excited. We always want to play with things because you're doing experiments. That's what we do, right? Like, and it's like a chemical reaction. Oh, oops. Okay, I guess we shouldn't do that again. Just that the problem here is that with this sort of technology, it's beyond the lab. I think that's when it gets really tricky, right? Because you start to put this out in the real world. It's not a controlled environment. And so we tend to think, well, they want to regulate this stuff. And we understand why you should regulate it. But when you say AI, or you kind of like, we tend to think you're just using these broad strokes of very complex field. That's the first thing that we often see. It's like, you can't just use AI ML. Like, that's such a big space. That's like cutting off everything. That's like taking the air completely out of the room. And that's the first thing that kind of comes to our mind is like, okay, well, can you taxonomize the space? And okay, then we can say, okay, then we can agree. Okay, certain areas need to be very carefully studied. You might have to have quote unquote IRB style kind of things or protocols. Or like when you're doing animal studies, we have learned that, okay, well, if you're doing animal side of research, is it humane and all kinds of things? You know, I'm not a biologist or anything, but like, you know, people have those kinds of mechanisms. We've done all these things. I just kind of think like, if we spend a little bit of time kind of carving out what we really mean and which areas we're touching on, then I think it will let the scientists kind of calm down a little bit because yes, we are responsible people. At the end of the day, we're coming with all this technology so we can all enjoy it. That's the true thing, right? We do want to do things for good. So if we can break it down and taxonomize it and sit at the table and have a deeper level of a conversation, you know, that's a two-way handshake. We also got to be willing to sit at the table. In all honesty, we tend to be dismissive of that because we're like, well, it's not nerdy. Like, yeah, it's just like a bunch of paperwork moving around. Like, you know, okay, I don't want to do that. But I think like if we are also willing to do that, a scientist sit at the table and say, okay, well, I can teach you what this is. And then in exchange, you are willing to say, okay, you can play in this sort of a space, incubate, innovate, and all that. Then I think, you know, you start getting into a more, in a better playground. There's a playground for everybody.
Over the years, I think there's been a lot of talk of assisting Congress. I mean, these are elected officials, often from small districts. You know, sometimes they don't even have college degrees. If they're going to be opining on these things and offering legislation, that having technical assistance would be extremely helpful. Separate from that, I think there's a strong feeling inside Washington, which is there's got to be a track in and out of the private sector and in and out of academia. So people who, for example, have to put their kids through college can eventually leave government service and make enough money to do that and be able to return to government service when that spending portion of their lives concludes because maybe they find it more fulfilling. But the engagement between people with technical know-how and scientific understanding and people who don't can also be frustrating. Because I do think brains operate differently. And I've seen this a lot up close. Well, is there anything else that you want to say to us tonight, knowing that we're sort of an Inside the Beltway national security podcast, a lot of lawyers, a lot of technical people?
Everybody wants to be an astronaut. Nobody wants to be the rocket scientist. And I mean that, you know, there's lots of people who want to talk about AI, who want to do things with AI. And this goes all the way from students to people in industry and so forth. But at the end of the day, AI is at a point where a lot of AI astronauts sort of, you know, discovering things are going to be self-contained. They're going to be autonomous to an extent. We're all on that cusp already. It's going to happen, right? We're already on that cusp. But we do need those rocket scientists who can actually build all this technology and understand what that means. So, okay, the two aspects to it, which kind of comes back to the things we talked about. One is capability, right? Which is like, okay, can I just build the computer that quote unquote only does multiply and additions and scale that to trillion scale, right? We need engineers who are capable of doing that. And there's a shortfall of that. Building those computer chips is also a very technical skill at the very deep nanometer regime that we operate at, right? Or that little switch that we turn on and off. We're talking about trillions of these that are packed together. And you need just one to go bust in the wrong place and the entire chip is pretty much useless. So we need very solid curriculum. This is a much more longer term sort of planning for what the country truly needs. There is that. And it's so important to get those rocket scientists training in place and focus on, are we making sure we get all that right? Because without them, you can't truly deal with the energy thing. People are worried about all this energy and sustainable AI and so forth, right? And I can tell you candidly, students come around and say, oh, I want to like, you know, do something about the planet. Like, you know, I want to do about save the planet. I want to do all this. And so much of the time we struggle with this because we're like, that's great. Now let's get back to the fundamentals. And so you can learn to be the chemist or the electrical engineer or the computer scientist with very deep knowledge. And that goes back to this, you know, a rocket scientist thing. You want to build a rocket? Well, you have to specialize in one piece of the rocket. And we need so many different specialists working together. And I think that's critical because right now people are kind of disillusioned. And increasingly we're seeing people and students and parents all saying, okay, well, I want them to work on these exciting topics. Yeah, they're exciting. But to make a small change in there, you need deep specialization. And I think that's where people are missing the forest for the trees.
Vijay, it's been really great to talk to you. Yeah, I'm really glad likewise. That you came on. We're going to hyperlink a lot of what you have written into the notes to this cast. I would encourage people who are interested in this to take a look at the book that I've referenced, the open source book that he has available to you. I found it highly accessible. Don't be deterred. If you want to know more and you're thinking about developing some sort of interest in this space, even as a lawyer, I would suggest that you do that. I think that if this is your area of interest, he's a really good person to tap into his work. Thanks. We're really glad you came.
Thank you for having me. This was super fun.
And thank you, everyone, for listening to NSLT. Be sure to give us a rating, if you would, please. Go ahead and like us or do anything that you want in terms of sharing. You know, obviously, that triggers the algorithm. It's called social media amplification. I'll go ahead and say that right. Did I get that right, Vijay? What we try to do is start conversations that then prompt further conversations. Best way to do that is have a conversation with somebody that you don't agree with. Listen to each other, because we think that that is a very good way to build your skills as a lawyer. It's also a great way to build your skills as a scientist. Encourage people to challenge your thoughts. It also brings the country together. We're not exactly in the most unified moment in history right now, but I do think listening and not shouting and not disparaging each other is a critical piece. So feel free to share this podcast with a friend. And again, we bring you cost-free content and we think substantive discussions on a lot of areas involving national security law. And again, listening will improve your skills as a lawyer. So we're going to say goodnight tonight for this part of our podcast series on AI and our growing energy needs. And we will be talking to you about nuclear energy in the coming weeks and sort of where it fits into this growing need for data storage and whether or not it's even suitable for that. Thank you for listening. Our producer, writer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I am always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producers, plural, but let's start with the great Holly McMahon and all the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. These are the big brains inside Washington, quite frankly, bipartisan group of people that have open conversations with each other, and they're all the top of their game, the best lawyers in the business. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next time.
Hey, podcast listeners, this is Holly, and tagging on to Elisa's great discussion, just to remind you all that the committee is now accepting nominations for the Morris Liebman Award. The deadline is March 14. We'll link to the nomination form in the reference section. But as some background, the Liebman Award in Law and National Security was established by our committee, which honors the memory of Morris Liebman, a distinguished lawyer, co-founder of our committee, and recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. The award recognizes Morris Liebman's lifelong dedication to the rule of law, leadership in the field of law and national security affairs, and continuing support for those engaged in this field. Persons eligible for this award must have demonstrated a sustained commitment and made contributions to the field of law and national security, whether through government service, legal scholarship, or otherwise. Again, we'll link to the nomination form in the reference section of this podcast, along with a list of past recipients. Remember, the deadline is March 14.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.